Welcome to the NQF SRE Steering Committee. Please note today's call is being recorded. I would now like to turn the call over to Mr. Peter Angood. Please go ahead, sir.
Thank you very much, and good morning, everybody. Thank you for joining us and taking some more time out of your busy schedules. We do have a lot of work to cover this morning. We did background, perspective, and context setting at the meeting from last week, so we won't bother with anything further in that direction. Although we had a long holiday weekend in the middle of the time between last week and this week, we have tried to process all of the documents, including some summary notes, some notes on definition of end of surgery, serious disability, and combining some of the newly submitted safe practices on communication and test results. And hopefully you'll have a chance to look at those if they came in late to your mailbox. We will, however, certainly display them on the webpage as we move through the conference. So I'm going to keep my comments short and brief, and I'll turn this immediately back over to Sally Tyler and Greg Meyer for them to lead us through today's adventures.
Thanks, Peter. Thanks to everyone who's on the call. We had a good turnout for the last call, and I think this is going to be equally good and hopefully finish up this part of the discussion to get us through both newly submitted SREs and the existing, so we can continue to do our work on that. So that's all I have. Greg?
This is Greg. Thank you again for those that went through the slog of all the new submissions last time. I think we had some great feedback on those. A couple of quick reminders that the work ahead of us today is to review the existing SREs. We also have a couple of late submissions that we'd like to get to at the end, and there may be some additional definitional issues, particularly a discussion around serious disability, and we sent out materials related to that that we'd like to have after we get through the list of existing SREs. Other thing to note for folks is that for those of you that were not able to participate on the last call, that the plan is to translate our discussions from the last call and this call into what the equivalent of a Survey Monkey, so everyone will have a chance to officially kind of weigh in and vote, so we can ensure that we really do have a consensus around each of these. So there is an additional step to the process that will take place outside of these conference calls. And with that by way of background, I think we should dive right into to the list of existing SREs. Based on the experience of the last call, I think we're going to try to take these in order. We had a chance to hear from Stan Riley, who's not able to join us today, about the input from his group on office-based surgery with regard to the existing SREs. By way of reminder, I think that we should be able to move through these relatively quickly, but we will have a couple areas that will probably require additional conversation, such as fall pressure ulcers and criminal events. And so with that said, I'm going to be leaving at noon today, unfortunately, and as a result, I think I'll let Sally kind of guide us through this so that there's some continuity here. But we will begin with for those of you that are on the webinar, the surgical events, and the first one is surgery performed on the wrong body part. To remind you, our job is to look at the recommendations from the TAPS in addition to the NQF staff recommendation, and we are to come up with whether or not we agree with those recommendations, and in addition to that, whether or not we believe that this SRE applies to the hospital environment. We did not have a hospital environment TAP because that's where we started with the existing SREs. So at this point, comments on surgery performed on the wrong body part?
So from the office practice TAP, this is Tejal, hi. The main issue here, which is just relevant for all the surgical events, so these were definitely relevant to the surgery performed on the wrong body part, definitely relevant to our setting, and our recommendation was really just in terms of renaming these events to procedure rather than surgery, and also recommended that using the term site rather than body part. So a few changes in terms of the definition.
Yeah, and this is Eric from the Skilled TAP. Same thing, changing the descriptor invasive procedure. We actually blew past this one at first, thinking it was of no particular interest to us. And then as we got into the discussions, we said, wait a minute, no, this stuff makes sense too. And then we started to think about invasive procedures.
And our only other suggestion was as part of the implementation guide for all of these, just try to have examples from the various settings to kind of prompt people to think about it again in a setting where they might not necessarily initially have thought it was relevant.
Sound like excellent suggestions. Additional modifications to this one?
Michael, I would suggest procedure rather than invasive, and we can discuss, but I just throw it out.
You can't get up the phone.
Michael, can you give us an example of where you think that distinction may be important?
I've seen splints in appliances and other sorts of treatments that you might not necessarily describe as invasive, but the issue was not only what was done at the wrong site, but the right site was neglected. We don't have a thing here for not doing it on the right site, so we could comprehend them all if we just said you did something and you did it in the wrong place. In general, the reason why I would open it up that way is because the process that enables you to do something on the wrong site is typically the same, whether you're neglecting the right one or choosing the wrong one.
This is Duran. I just kind of throw out to the group the idea of creating clarity over these procedures that occur outside of the OR. And they really are a very different system of safety outside of the OR. And just kind of throw out, should we really have a new class for procedures performed outside of OR? Because these SREs are supposed to inform us as to where our risks are, and when we lump them together, then we don't create clarity.
It's Michael. You know, I tend to resist that. I wouldn't fight to the death over it, but the reason I resist it is because there are a lot of procedures in the OR that use different processes, and you have to violate a different kind of a rule to achieve them. So my instinct is to just fold them in, because there isn't going to be one remedy per SRE, no matter what.
In our health system, we've had a tougher time getting 100% performance at the timeout outside of the OR. Our numbers look good in the OR. It's sort of what informs my comment.
Well, okay. And the way I would deal with that in my institution would be to attach a variable for location. I mean, you know, you may even find that there's one OR, or it's children, or it's only orthopedics, or, you know, I think there's a lot of granularity that you could add to it for local value. But I think that maybe, well, my view of what the NQF ought to be doing is to provide the context and then let you add local variables.
Fair enough.
Any other comments on that one?
Did we want to discuss the comment number 6, add the phrase based on informed consent? I'm just looking at the summary of suggested modifications. Are we supposed to be reviewing that column as well on today's call? It says, on the master document that was sent out, the spreadsheet of existing and new SREs.
Yes, Michael, I would propose ignoring that one.
Yeah, I had a problem with that, too.
Additional comments? So, hearing none, I think that we'll make that change. We'll use that word procedure, and again, you'll have a chance to see the final wording of this in the SurveyMonkey. Move on to number 2. Hearing no objections, let's talk about surgery on the wrong patient.
So from the physician office tap, it was definitely relevant. There was some discussion about the informed consent piece here, because informed consent can be less formal potentially in the ambulatory environment and not documented as stringently. So because I think in terms of the initial definition of this, it talks about kind of correctly documented informed consent, and I think that may not apply as much in certain ambulatory situations. So the recommendations were, again, procedures rather than surgeries, site instead of body part, examples, et cetera. And then there was only that one issue of clarification of the informed consent piece.
And from the long-term care tap, we follow the same principle we had in the first discussion.
Further comments or recommendations?
Did we need to talk about number four in the summary of suggested modifications? It's defined as procedures where the universal protocol or WHO checklist apply, and maybe I just don't have that on the top of my head. I don't know if those are the same Venn diagram, universal protocol and the WHO checklist. That was from a comment from partners.
Yeah, Michael, I am a little stronger about not letting that, to me that's the tail and the column A is the horse. I don't think we should let the remedies or the violation define what the error is. And again, in my liability experience, we have almost 50% of the procedures that we would define as wrong patient or wrong site are not the kind of things where the surgical standard checklists would apply.
Right, and certainly not the WHO checklist as well. That's exactly.
This is Diane. I would agree with that.
So the sense is that would be a little bit too constraining.
Correct.
Yes.
This is Sally. I have a question, just procedure, a little bit housekeeping. Since we've had a couple of questions about things on the suggested modification list, are we considering that side by side as we consider these events, or should we set those aside to consider later? Are they considered simultaneously? That, just for my clarification, I'm a little confused here.
Yeah, it's Peter, and I would suggest that we do it simultaneously.
Okay.
And some of them being meaningful and should have a bit more discussion. Others, as we've already done, just a quick agreement to move past it and not necessarily include it.
And the TAPS did look at these as we went through each
mm-hmm.
of the items.
Yeah, thanks, Eric. That's correct.
Okay, any further comments on the wrong surgery performed on the wrong patient? Right. One thing, just to clarify, when people don't comment, I'm assuming that what that means is that people agree with, generally with the staff recommendation, what you hear from the TAPS, in addition to that, that you agree that this applies to the hospital setting. And I think that's pretty much a no-brainer for these for this first set. But just to make sure that everybody recognizes that that's the way we're interpreting the silence here.
Aye.
I think everybody's waiting to chomp into falls, pressure ulcers, and criminal events.
Right, but first, we have to talk about wrong surgical procedures performed on a patient. Any further comments beyond those, which I think the preceding comments about the wording and procedure and such all would stand for this one as well? Additional comments? Okay.
Same issue with the informed consent.
Exactly. Okay. There was one additional question that was embedded. This came actually from, it was a question about the procedure being done at the wrong level of the spine. This actually came from Stan Riley's group, and the question is whether or not whether folks would think that would be the wrong surgical procedure. And I think that so I'm interested if anybody would disagree that is something that ought to be considered here.
Michael, well, I disagree.
Yeah, I disagree too. This is Diane. I think a correct procedure, but on the wrong level of the spine, would be considered a wrong site or wrong body part for us.
Yep. Okay. In the end, my sense is it's a problem, and the underlying failure is pretty much the same for them. But I think that definitionally that we so folks would favor this going under wrong site.
Sounds right to me.
Right.
Okay. Terrific. Okay, let's move to retention of foreign objects. Just to remind the group that we spent some time at the close of the last call discussing that the issue around the end of surgery, we did that in some detail. We settled in on that that wheels out definition. And so any further modifications or any further discussion people would like to have about this?
Yes, Michael, although when you have wheels, I think the wheels out is probably okay. We see four categories of retained foreign objects in our experience, and one of those categories is wound debris that's frequently encountered after treatment in the emergency room where there are no wheels. And I think that it's easy to make an analogy about when you're done with the patient in the ER, but we see splinters, glass, asphalt, and our most notorious one is brake handle from a motorcycle as retained objects where patients were dismissed and sent home. Just to make it more confusing, the four categories we see that we measure are hard surgical goods, soft surgical goods, anatomic specimens, and wound debris. And we lump them all into retained foreign body. That may be right or wrong, but I just wanted to make sure that people considered whether all of those would be comprised under what they see here, whether they should, whether they're happy with that.
Could you say more about wound debris, Michael?
Products of conception, appendiceal stump, fragment of the pedicle, kidney, half of a kidney, you know, stuff that you meant to remove but you didn't.
I think for us, our definition in Minnesota would not capture those. We look at things that were intentionally placed and were intended to be removed but were not. But we would not capture things that were intended to be removed but were not placed by the provider in the first place. So we would not capture those types of wound debris.
Same in Pennsylvania.
Again, I'm not sure I have a special fondness for the other types, but if so, then you might clarify this one by then saying medical instrumentation or material, including soft goods such as catheter tips, drains, sponges, and hard goods, including instruments and guide wires and trocars.
Yeah, it's Peter Angood. I would caution the group a little bit. We have a large external viewership on this issue of defining end of surgery, and their comments to us so far pretty much focus in on kind of the Minnesota version of life. You've left behind things that you brought in, and you shouldn't have left them behind. If we expand the scope overly large, we may create more confusion than clarity.
Yeah. I agree. Then that really, we want to look at the word foreign then for clarification purposes.
And that's the first summary of suggested modification. Simply suggests use the term medical or surgical item rather than foreign object?
I don't know that we've ever had a problem with people understanding foreign object, though. I mean, to me, that seems like such an intuitive term to use. It's an object that's foreign to that person's body. And I would worry a little bit that if we limit it to medical or surgical, that might almost be a little bit more vague. Because what about things like we've had a piece of a drape that, you know, tore off and was retained in the patient inadvertently. I don't know if someone would consider that a medical or surgical item per se, but it was a foreign object that ended up being in this patient's body that we considered reportable. So I wonder if that might create some new gray areas that are not currently there.
Yeah,
this is
Greg. I agree that I don't think that I've encountered a lot of confusion around the determination of foreign object. Although this latest discussion with the potential inclusion of things like organs that were not fully removed as part of it is much broader than we have been thinking about it. And I do share Peter's concern that I think to stick with the knitting here and focus in on the events that that Minnesota is following and others are following is the right place to be right now. I'm afraid that the can of worms and some of the definitional issues would really open up. People can use these locally how they seem fit. And if you want to broaden the definition, I don't think that's a problem. But I would have a concern about broadening it here for everybody.
Well, and I think too, this is Diane again. I think too that things like part of an organ or product of conception. I think you're really talking about a different issue there and a different error process. And the way we've tried to think about retained foreign objects is, and the way we've defined the end of surgery is we look at those processes that are in place to capture retained objects like counts and reconciliation. And none of those are intended to capture things like retained products of conception. And so it just feels to me like a fundamentally different type of event than a retained foreign object.
Diane, I think you're right. But what do you do with bullets, and other stuff like that? I think this comment one here really makes you want to answer. Are we going to ignore the question here under comment one?
Yeah, it just doesn't feel like it fits in this category. I would lean more towards discussing it as a separate item. But again, I think we wouldn't consider a bullet. Yes, it's a foreign object, but it's not one that was placed by that care team. And so if it was left in when it was intended to be removed, the processes that broke down are probably very different than the processes that broke down resulting in a retained foreign object as we more traditionally define it.
It also makes it more ambiguous as some bullets may be left in as the risk may be too great to remove them.
Right.
Well, that would be an intentionally retained.
Yeah.
That's like a catheter for me. I'm going to defer because I sense a sense of the meeting, but the comment I would add here is going to come up again for me for a couple of these others, whether we have a vision in our mind of what the process is that broke down that essentially implicitly defines what our event is, and I think that will break down when we have events where there are clearly many processes that might lead to the same outcome. And so I would just say to be cautious about saying when we think we know what the process ought to be, then that helps us know what the event is.
No, I think point taken, and I agree with that. But I just my gut still tells me that there are very different issues at play, although there can be many reasons why a retained object happens or why the issues that you're talking about happen. Even without saying what I think the cause is, I think that the processes that are at play in those two types of events are generally going to be different ones. And my sense of the retained foreign object category was always that it was intended to address situations where something was placed by a provider and then was not removed and was not reconciled at the end of that procedure, rather than cases where there was something that was already inherent in the patient, something that was already present at the point when the procedure began that was not removed. To me, those are different things. I'm not sure if I can articulate it better than saying that it's my gut feeling, but they just feel like very different types of events and different processes to me, and I think that that would be an expansion of the category far beyond how most people really think of it in practice right now.
I agree, and I wouldn't remove that from your gut, but would you...
But would you consider,
what about narrowing it by saying medical or surgical item? That seems to get around the problem of contaminating the field with these other objects. And I think it seems to agree with what you're saying, that, yeah, it's something in the medical care process rather than a souvenir they brought in from outside.
I would support that, and it adds further clarity.
Yeah, I think as long as there's clarification to go along with it about what we mean by medical or surgical object. Again, I don't think we've had much confusion here in Minnesota about retained foreign object. There's pretty broad acceptance and understanding of that category, so it's not something we've ever really considered a problem. But if you changed it to medical and surgical items or surgical items, I think you're right, that would address the problem that you've raised. But I would want to see along with that some very clear guidance about what is and is not included in the
And that could be provided in some in the examples. So the drape, I think, is a good example.
We have a Bovie scratch pad.
And, Michael, I won't remove it from my gut, but will you consider it retained if I leave it there?
Yes, but not foreign. It's intentionally retained.
So we'll try out this new language, and we'll pass that by the group. Any other comments?
Yeah, it's Peter Angood. The retained foreign body has become a fairly common term within healthcare, and so it'll be interesting to see, as a steering committee, if we move through this language on the final version. I would expect there to be a fair amount of public comment during the public comment period. But
just because it's such a... It's such a well-known term, and
yeah.
I guess a quick question for Peter and perhaps Helen and Melinda. I know they're at NQF. So we've heard from Minnesota that doesn't seem to be an issue there. I don't see the current wording it being an issue here in terms of difficulty to interpret. But are you hearing that there are some difficulties nationally?
Well, it's Peter again. More of the issue is the definition of the end of surgery, and then everybody pretty much says, and then it's a retained foreign body. There doesn't seem to be a drumbeat to change the term retention of foreign body. It's the drumbeat is to change the definition of end of surgery.
Yeah, and this is Helen. Totally ditto to what Peter just said. The end of surgery is the issue. I've not heard any grumblings about foreign body.
It's Michael. I hate to be annoying, but we just did a review of the literature because we're doing a report on this. Trying to write a paper, case series, and what we found is that the literature is very confused about what people report.
Well, and this is Diane. I will say, although we have not had any confusion, one thing that I did just think of is that we've started working with our Department of Human Services to use Medicaid administrative data to potentially identify retained foreign objects and other surgical events as a cross-check for our reporting. And as we've looked at potential retained foreign objects that they've flagged in their data, there have been a couple of cases where things were coded as a retained object, but it was more cases like what Michael was talking about. It was something that we wouldn't consider reportable as a retained object, but that was coded as such, and therefore, since we have a non-payment policy in Minnesota for our Medicaid program, there was no payment for that case, but it ended up not actually being a retained object. So I think on the coding side, there has been a little bit of confusion about what it means.
Well, then it's Peter, and I think there is an evolution in the language, and historically in the literature, it doesn't surprise me to hear Michael say that it is confusing. I guess my counter to it is, if we create more language, do we create more confusion, as opposed to allowing the evolution of this term, retention of foreign body, to get more solid in the lexicon?
Well, I think we'll put it out to the opinion of the group.
Just in terms of new language, if you are going to be, this is Sally, developing new language, I would, since you're anticipating some public comment on this, would definitely, if you're thinking on the new language, not include the term souvenir. If that was from the consumer viewpoint, I don't think anybody wants to think about it that way.
Well taken. Any additional comments on retention of a foreign object or medical or surgical item? Okay. Last, the intraoperative or immediately postoperative death in an ASA class 1 patient.
So from the physician office tap, we actually thought this was definitely relevant to our setting, but one issue we had was with the ASA class piece, because we felt that really any death associated with a procedure done in the ambulatory setting would be something that's reportable, since these are theoretically low-risk procedures. So the language we recommended, at least for that setting, and I'm not sure how it's going to work with the different settings, but we talked about death during or immediately after an ambulatory procedure, and we'd have to clarify again sort of the what's immediately after, but that was the suggestion from the office practice folks.
And from the skilled nursing facility tap, we don't have anybody in a nursing home that's a class 1 patient.
Well, that makes it.
If you did, Eric, it would be reportable, right?
Yeah.
That would be the reportable piece.
Question.
That's
one
right.
One quick question for you, for the group. There are, I guess, one could consider, for example, resuscitation as a procedure. Patient goes to an outpatient visit, has an arrest, and dies. Would that be reportable under your kind of definition here?
I don't think we were thinking about something like resuscitation. I think we were definitely thinking more about, we could even think about the language of, you know, scheduled procedure or something like that. We were definitely not thinking about a code, for example. And I don't think that's what what we would want reported, just because those are, you know, survival from codes is highly variable anyway.
Yeah, so I think we'd want to maybe add some language there about excluding resuscitation procedures.
Right. That's a good thought.
Was there a comment submitted about expanding this beyond ASA class 1? I don't know that the TAPS discussed it, but I thought one of the comments that was submitted was questioning whether we should expand it beyond that.
I seem to remember that.
Well, for the TAP, though, for the physician office TAP, that, you know, we definitely expanded it just because we felt like, you know, well, they probably shouldn't be having a routine ambulatory procedure if they're higher risk ASA class.
But somebody that gets something under conscious sedation in the SNF environment, again, wouldn't be class 1. So it wouldn't even be close because
the definition of skilled care, it's getting into skilled care. There are a whole host of responsibilities and requirements to make that level.
Right. I think those are, they're not in class 2. Those are
no.
Much higher classes. And so to me, I don't think this can be solved with what Diane mentioned, maybe, you know, letting it leak over into class 2. I think this is a case where if we're going to expand to what I see happen in the SNF, we're going to have to add an or statement that admits a new bunch of people. And it looks to me like that or statement is what was suggested. So it seemed like or an ambulatory or SNF environment, something like that. They just shouldn't die, right? So, but it isn't the class that makes it the problem.
Well, it's the problem, but it's also what fences this in, and I think it makes it interpretable for many as well.
We should probably move on, because I think if we tried to expand the classification, we'd get into so much difficulty defining who's in and who's out.
It's Peter. I tend to agree with that. ASA-1 is pretty clean.
Yeah.
ASA-2 and 3, there's a lot of latitudes, and then the end, you know, near-death experience is fairly clear at what that is as well. So.
This is Greg. I agree as well, and I guess one of the things to remember is that this doesn't just come out as a list. It does come out as a report, and it is, you know, it's legitimate for that report to reflect some of these deliberations. Say this is something that the steering committee did consider whether or not this ought to be expanded, in particular to make it apply to other settings. And right now we felt that the ambiguity that would introduce would probably make it more difficult to implement. But this is a future issue that this steering committee will over time be tackling.
When you say future, in the next round? I mean,
well,
when do you think it would break it down?
My view of the work of this committee and the SREs are that this is evolving. It will reflect the evolution of not just technology and science, but also the culture of care and expectations of consumers and patients. And so the notion that we're going to get this fixed all at once is difficult, and I think this is a place where things are still evolving, and it would be it's a great placeholder to send a report. We consider this, and we'll continue to consider it in the future, and I am sure this will evolve with time. Other comments on ASA Class 1?
I think we can move on then.
Yep, great. Doctor device events. So first up is the is death or serious disability associated with the use of contaminated drugs, devices, or biologics provided by the healthcare facility.
This for the skilled nursing facility TAP, this fits right in, and we didn't have any problems with this.
And for the physician office TAP, it also fit right in. And the only thing we suggested was in the definition it says healthcare facility, and we wanted to say healthcare setting, just because facility seemed a little more inpatient-y. But other than that, we didn't have any issues.
So this is Duran. I just a question about death or serious disability. So if you develop HIV or Hep C, and you're not dead and you're not seriously disabled, how do we reconcile that?
This is Michael. I've been thinking a lot about this, and I want to make two very short comments that actually are very big comments. Comment one, this is the first thing on the list that where the reporting criteria is not all such, but it is only those such that have a given kind of level of seriousness. And I have been playing the game of adding a column to all of these where I said, what's the event, the name of the event, and what is the criteria we have for reporting? When it's wrong patient, apparently our criteria is each such. When it's contaminated needle, our criteria apparently is, right now, only death or disability resulting. We don't care about the rest. Now, in that column of reporting criteria, if you allow me virtually, this is one where I would say, because we're going to get to that lower down later, maybe, when you infer a risk of future death or serious injury that is substantially increased over what you had before. For example, when you change the level of their cancer because of delay, or hepatitis B or C is another terrific example. You may not even change their life at all, but you've changed medical monitoring for life, you've changed the risk category, you've changed the way they live and the way they think of themselves, and to me those are serious injuries. It's the injury called risk. And I think we should wrestle with that.
We're on the same page.
On our last call, I know that we had discussed, because the term serious disability didn't seem to be inclusive enough, to talk about more serious harm, to include that in some of the other definitions. I certainly think in the examples that you all just gave of Hep C and HIV, that would qualify, certainly.
Or is this one where at this level, at the actual SRE level, we use the risk thereof if we want to include, for some reason, death or disability, if that has to stay? You could say, or the risk thereof. We didn't have that at the top level, at the definition of what an SRE is, but we said we would bring that back in as needed at each individual SRE discussion point.
This is Michael. Now, I don't want to argue against my own point, but I'll tell you a severe difficulty with risk thereof, and that is when you go to juries and you sit in trials where somebody is making a claim for risk, it's not at all straightforward how you define risk. And when you simply say risk of death, that applies to every time you get on an airplane, or get in a car, or actually cross the street or breathe. And so juries there's a lot of trial transcript that goes around in a very unconstructive way when you allow that term risk thereof. So my experience would lead me to say you're going to have to be more explicit than that if you're going to you quantified injury here, death or serious disability. If you're going to do something with risk, I think you're going to have to quantify risk, not simply say wide open asymptotic risk. There has to be a cutoff of some kind.
Well, I guess you're getting to the fact that you could be contaminated by something that which there really is no risk, and who cares if you're contaminated with an innocuous substance. But if you're exposed due to a contamination of a drug or a device to an agent that increases your risk of death, that is a little bit differently. So it's really dependent on what you are exposed to a certain extent, and 'cause then we open that up. If you don't have death or serious disability in there, and we say every associated instance of the contamination, then how do you define a contamination?
Yes. Let's take maybe, I don't know if this will help, needle sticks. Are we asking here for a hospital report all needle sticks? And my suggestion would be no, that's ridiculous. There's too many. There's a process for needle sticks, and the watershed there for me is some of them really do end up resulting in a change in a person's risk status for life, meaningfully. I use the phrase substantial risk. And then some of them, you wipe your sweat and you say, oh, phew, no change in risk. Boy, were you lucky, near miss. And I would say don't report those. Let's make a really absurd example. Suppose I don't do the ceremony of wiping your skin with alcohol and then give you a flu shot. Suppose someone then says, there's a risk of contamination there if you don't do the ceremony.
this is Phil Schneider. Is there a possibility of these long-term hazards like HIV